The following programming is sponsored by Don Beischel. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Peasley Media Group. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here when you hear my...
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860. This is Gary Heasley. I'm hosting the show today. Don Beischel, who has hosted the show for, I think, the last 6 years, has taken a job with Doug Mastriano's team to help fight for the conservative cause in the Pennsylvania legislature. We're sorry to see Don not be here, but we're really glad he's there. So we've put together a show today that is going to be hitting a couple of really important issues, I think, and it should be quite interesting. First, we're going to talk about this issue of the petrodollar and what does it mean and what do the jobs numbers mean? Because we hear a lot of mixed messages, not much about the end of the petrodollar agreement and what that might mean for the dollar, but we'll talk about that. We're going to have Joel Griffith join us. He is an economist with the Heritage Foundation. At 12:30, we're going to have Garrett Ziegler join us. Garrett is the founder of Marco Polo, the group that actually wrote the book on the Hunter Biden laptop. And I've got a copy of that book. I've been through it. It is shocking. And so we may talk a bit about what it means that he's been convicted of this gun charge. But that book has got some other things in it that maybe need to be addressed. At 1 o'clock, we're going to be joined by Kim Kelly of Uniting America, Inc. Kim is creating a sanctuary for victims of child sex trafficking. And, you know, this issue, for reasons that I struggle to accept, is one that Americans aren't talking about enough. And we're going to talk about exactly what is the scope and scale of this industrial scale child trafficking industry and what the implications are and how it's happening and what has to be done to help these children first get rescued and then recovered. Because this isn't something where a child is abused like that and then simply walks away. So Kim Kelly of Uniting America, Inc. will join us at 1 o'clock, and we're going to have a discussion with that. She'll be in the studio, so we'll have a chance to go back and forth. Now, if you would like to ask questions or make comments, you're welcome to join the show and participate in the conversation by dialing 888-329-3306. That number again is 888-329-3306. If you've got questions for Kim specifically, we're going to have an hour-long segment with her, so there'll be time in the back half to do that. But if you've got other comments, feel free to call and toss them in. So with that, we're going to kick off the conversation with Joel. Joel, welcome to The Conservative Voice once again.
Hey, thanks for having me. Always glad to be on.
Yeah, glad you're here, because I got to tell you, I'm looking at things that are happening that to me appear to be unprecedented in economic history. I'm looking at things that seem to have potential implications that will be very significant, and not just to capital markets or some distant, money managers in Wall Street, but really to the American people, to the American family and the individuals, the folks that are young and trying to build a life, and the folks that are looking at retirement and trying to maintain some kind of a lifestyle as they head into retirement. One of the issues we've been struggling with mightily, as you and I've talked about, is inflation. Everybody knows that while the government keeps telling us inflation is very low, we know that the prices of the things we're buying are significantly higher than they were. But there's one thing that happened that didn't get a lot of media coverage. I was talking to one of the smart people I spend time talking to, and we were going back and forth on this the other day, this idea that this petrodollar is going to end. And we've all heard the phrase petrodollar for years and years and years, but I don't think we all understand exactly what that means. And so just to put some context to this, this petrodollar was a deal cut with the United States and Saudi Arabia 50 years ago that said that Saudi won't trade oil in other currencies in exchange. We protect Saudi. And late last year, early this year, Saudi announced that they're not going to renew that agreement. That agreement expired on June 9th. So the question that I've got for you as an economist is, does this matter? I mean, we know that being the world's reserve currency has given us great benefits, but we really can't quantify those. And if Saudi starts trading commodities in other currencies and other currencies begin to take over in other markets, does it matter?
Yeah, it's a great question. Even and with the petrodollar, another thing that most people aren't aware of is that the terms of one of the initial agreements, The Saudis would go ahead and invest their dollars from the oil revenue in United States Treasury bonds, and the interest that would flow back to the kingdom, that would then be, under the agreement, diverted to our defense industry to purchase armaments for the kingdom against our enemies. And it was an arrangement that worked quite well, both for the United States Treasury, also for the Saudis, and also for the defense contractors. And that was in place for many years. I think that Saudi Arabia now choosing to allow its oil trade to be in other currencies beyond the dollar, it's really a recognition on their part of a lot of changed realities in the geopolitical space. As your listeners are well aware, the United States has sanctions on a number of governments, and I think for very good cause, including Russia and Iran. And when you're working as a major trading partner, as Saudi Arabia is in selling oil across the globe, though those types of sanctions regimes, they pose the threat, both now and in the future, of really impacting their trade. And this is, I think, a way for them to avoid some of those concerns going forward. Monetarily, I don't think this is going to have a huge impact as of right now on our own economy. However, I think that when you see a major oil supplier such as Saudi Arabia begin to allow these transactions in other currencies, that could potentially impact our national security. Because right now we're able to rely upon the world banking system with our allies, and we're able to rely on the fact that our dollar is used in most international transactions. It allows us to exercise, if you will, soft power rather than military power in executing our foreign policy objectives. If our dollar loses some more of its relevance in the international marketplace, that's going to make it less possible for us to actually accomplish our objectives without resorting to actually using our military hardware or putting the lives of our men and women on the line.
Right.
And that's my primary concern right now with the petrodollar situation.
Yeah, so it certainly that geopolitical element, I don't think people are considering, but it's a great point. And if you look at other commodities or just commodities as a whole, and certainly energy, it is now happening that, for example, oil is trading in Chinese yuan or renminbi. It is the reality that I think we see more trading in rubles. And there was a big shift in the world balance of power at the beginning of the year, I think, when Saudi Arabia and other nations joined this thing called BRICS, which was Brazil, Russia, India, and China, that banded together many years ago to form sort of a trading bloc, an economic alliance that would allow them to sort of counter the West and grow their economic power against the West. Well, now that group has expanded to BRICS Plus, and I think it's in the neighborhood of 40 countries. And BRICS now controls about 60% of the oil supply globally. So now you've got Saudi Arabia willing to trade in other currencies. You've got other nations like China and Russia beginning to trade in their own currencies. And you've got this shift in control, handing some of those commodities into the BRICS envelope, this BRICS alliance. That seems also to challenge a bit our status as the world's reserve currency. And to your point a moment ago, to challenge our ability then to use our economic power to execute our geopolitical goals as a nation.
Yeah, and on the reserve currency point, this is where we have to ask ourselves, why is it that we should care whether or not our dollar is used as reserve currency of the world? And it's something we haven't had to think about as regular folks for very often. But mm-hmm. we need to keep in mind that for many decades now, our government has acted in a fiscally reckless manner. But we have been able to escape many of the consequences associated with us because a lot of the surplus dollars that we've produced, when they get sent overseas in order to purchase our imports, and we've had a trade deficit for many years, which is, by the way, not necessarily a bad thing. We've exchanged our paper dollars, if you will, for goods, valuable goods and services. But those dollars have to go somewhere. Now, those dollars start just flooding back to the United States. That's going to create more inflation. We've even been able to avoid a lot of the inflationary impact of all the reckless spending habits here in the United States because other countries have chosen to maintain their foreign capital reserves of trillions of dollars. They've chosen to do that by holding on to those U.S. dollars. In other words, they've actually helped us avoid a lot of the consequences of that inflation by not just engaging in trade with the dollars, but by actually parking trillions of dollars at their own central banks.
Mm-hmm.
The danger, if we lose that reserve currency status, is now those dollars end up getting injected back here in a way that could ramp up inflation. And we've actually seen that the current reserve currency status threatened in recent years because investors and central banks are realizing that our politicians here don't seem serious at all about getting our fiscal house in order in the future. And of course, we might not default on our debt obligations, technically default, because we'll keep making the interest payments. But if we're going to start making those interest payments by printing more dollars,
mm-hmm.
that's going to diminish the value of those dollars that they have been holding in reserve. And investors are being able to catch on, both private investors and also government investors, sovereign investors are starting to recognize that, wow, our politicians aren't serious about this. Our dollar is likely to lose even more of its value going forward. This inflationary episode that we've seen in the past few years is just a precursor of what's likely to follow as our entitlement system goes bust. And that is why they've been diminishing the amount of reserves they hold. I mean, look at China, for instance. We used to hear about the concerns of China holding so much of our debt. That's actually not really so much of a concern anymore, because China has already sold off the bulk of their U.S. bond holdings. Only about 3% of our total $33 trillion of debt is actually owned by China now. So China's already caught on. And my fear is that if we don't get our fiscal house in order, we could really see our reserve status decline quickly going forward. And that's going to wreak a lot of economic havoc.
So we continue to be told, and it's actually an ever-growing commentary now, that inflation is caused not by all this currency stuff you're talking about. It's instead caused by somehow corporate greed, that somehow from 2021 until now, suddenly corporations have become greedy and they're just charging more. Are you telling me that's not true?
Well, it is true. Corporations are charging more. We've all experienced that. But is the inflation the result of the greed? No, that's a load of malarkey. And here's why. If you look at real family income, we know that real family income has declined by, adjusted for inflation, when I say real family income, of course, it's declined by around 4.5% over the past few years. Well, guess what? We keep hearing people like socialists like Senator Warren and even some populist Republicans claiming that corporations are just awash in all these profits. And yes, corporations are making more in nominal non-inflation adjusted dollars, just like you and I are probably making more in non-inflation adjusted dollars. When you adjust corporate profits by inflation, well, it turns out corporations have actually seen around a 4.5% decline in their real inflation adjusted income as well. And that makes sense, because the inflation that we're seeing now is a combination of two things. Number one, it's all the trillions of dollars that were printed. If you look at the Fed balance sheet, you see around a $6 trillion increase in the amount of assets they had, that's the dollars they've created, and that gets multiplied as it's injected into the economy. So you have more dollars chasing goods and services. That runs up the prices. But there's also a second factor here. We have crimped supply. We first saw the supply constricted during COVID with all mm-hmm. the shutdowns, but now under the Biden administration, we have seen supply of labor and supply of goods impacted with all the regulations. It's making it more difficult to produce. So you've got government on both ends of the scale here, both on the supply side, restricting supply, while increasing demand artificially with more dollars. That has created the inflation. And free market economists warned about this. And even some of those on the left, like Larry Summers, who was Obama's chief economist, he warned about this as well.
Yep.
And yet we saw both the Trump administration and then the Biden administration piling on with this reckless spending and the printing that has created the inflation that we're dealing with today. Everyone, I bet most of the listeners, most of us received those stimulus checks at the tail end of the Trump administration. Everybody loved getting those automatic deposits in their checking account for a few thousand dollars. Well, now we're paying for all that. Now each and every year, our income is around $4,000 less per year. I don't think those stimulus checks were such a great deal.
Exactly. Touching on some things that E.G. Antoni, your colleague at the Heritage Foundation, put out this week. The first point he made is, are things better than June 22? Well, yes, in one way to think about it. The average weekly paycheck is $153 larger than it was in January of 21. But it buys $41 less of goods and services. So on an inflation-adjusted real dollar value basis, our spending power and our incomes have gone down. And he did another analysis that he put up that said, you know, prices rising faster than earnings and interest rates going up for the average typical American family. He says it is the equivalent of knocking $7,800 off their annual income compared to January of 2021. You think about what that means. So the average family, I think median income in the United States is in around the $79,000 range. And this math is showing that about $7,800 of their income has come off. That's a 10% reduction in income. And, you know, in real terms, after adjusting for inflation, these issues are really are having a very significant impact on this typical average median American family. And now you add in some of the more geopolitical issues that I think we all struggle to grasp, like the petrodollar going away. And, you know, since 2015, both our competitor China and our ally Japan have been selling off their position of U.S. treasuries, meaning they're not buying as many as you said, right? Well, where did those, when they sold them, what happened? Well, demand went down, which means we have to now have the Fed buy more of our federal debt. You know, it's this sort of circular thing that's happening between Treasury and Fed. All of that drives inflation. And a lot of the central banks have shifted some of their purchases from dollars to gold. So their reserves are no longer held in dollars, but some of them in gold. Is that true as well?
Yeah, that's true. There's been a big shift by other central banks in buying up more gold. And and when there's less demand for our treasuries, we have to do one of two things, either have the Fed print the money to buy the bonds,
mm-hmm.
or increase the interest rates that the federal government is willing to pay on the bonds. And if you do that, that means the price of a bond falls because they're going to be paying more interest in effect. And that's what we've seen as well, which has a compounding effect. When you see the bulk of the federal debt, that the vast majority actually has to be refinanced in the past 2 years because the brilliant people at the Federal Reserve decided at a period of record low interest rates that they would go ahead and just issue mostly short-term bonds. Makes a lot of sense, right?
Right.
So now we have interest rates that have gone from just a fraction of 1% on short-term bonds. Now they've got to refinance this at 3.5%, 4.5% for the longer-term bonds. That means that the refinancing costs are just going to quite literally be astronomical, where the interest on the debt next year is likely to be more than we're spending on our military. It comes out to around closer to $15,000 per family of four just on the interest on the debt next year. It's a very serious situation. And in relation to you mentioned the total impact on families from the inflation, I think it's very correct, as E.G. and Tony did, to factor in the revolving debt cost. You know, the typical family has added around $4,000 worth of revolving debt over the past few years.
Wow.
Taking the typical family credit card debt to around $12,000. Well, when you have interest rates on credit card debt can go from, in many cases, around 13% to now closer to 22%. You know, it's just simple math. You multiply that 9% on the new debt total of $12,000. That's close to another $1,200 a year just in interest costs on the credit cards. I'm not even including the home and the auto loans.
Yep.
$1,200 a year per family and just additional interest costs on the revolving debt. And a lot of that new revolving debt was taken on just to pay the bills. I mean, this is demonstrably true. I mean, people have been using the cards to buy groceries, gasoline, and even pay their rent. And now they have to pay for that each and every year.
So you're seeing this massive explosion in consumer debt, which is now about $17.5 trillion. And I'm just going to go to one more E.J. Antoni comment that he made this week because I track his post. Interest on the debt in May was equal to 79% of all personal income taxes collected that month. No roads, no bridges, no hospitals, no military, no Medicare, no Social Security, just interest cost. So think about that. All the personal, not corporate, personal income taxes paid, of all that, 79% went to pay that interest, this $1 trillion-a-year burden we now carry. So you got that factor. And we've talked about these foreign governments now not buying our debt. They're trading out their dollars for gold. So they're buying gold, paying dollars. Those dollars come back into the market. And the federal government racking up this $1 trillion of incremental debt every 100 days that everyone now knows about, and these $2 trillion deficits, and just printing money. And it's not going to value. We're not getting $2 trillion of roads and bridges and infrastructure that's going to make the country more energy and otherwise efficient and productive, that's going to help us be a better global competitor. This money is just disappearing into the pockets of who knows whom. And so it's this is a catastrophic path we're on. And when I see these geopolitical moves like the end of the petrodollar and these shifts of other central banks, I start to worry because I don't see any interest in either the Republican or Democrat parties in curbing this spendathon, this ridiculously wasteful, irresponsible spending. I see these global issues continuing to move and accelerate, and I'm concerned that we're going to go from inflation to maybe hyperinflation. I don't think the American people are prepared for that. Am I just adding this up wrong?
No, you're very right. We know now for both candidates, we know how they've governed. We saw under the former President Trump, who did a lot of great things in deregulation and tax reductions. Those are all very positive. But when it comes to the spending side, that was the most fiscally reckless administration potentially in our nation's history. And I know it was done under the guise of countering COVID, and nearly all Republicans joined nearly all Democrats voting for this. But this was very reckless, and we're paying for it now. And now we know what Biden has done in his 3 years in office. He's made it even worse. And unfortunately, the primary cost drivers going forward that might bankrupt us are the entitlement situation. The so-called trust funds, which have hundreds of billions of dollars worth of government bonds in them, have been sold off. We're continuing to drain those down. And by 2034, that means that to make these entitlement payments for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, our government is going to have to make a choice because there's going to be nothing left in the trust fund. They're going to have to decide whether to slash these programs by potentially 20% or more, which I think they're highly unlikely to do, or they're going to have to raise taxes to pay for it, which is economically destructive and also highly unlikely that politicians can actually do that. The third option is going to be what they did during COVID. Just have the central bank print the funds to buy more debt to fund these programs. And if they do that, that means that we're going to have to deal with an extended period, potentially through the rest of our lifetimes, of elevated inflation of 5-7% per year, like we saw during the post-COVID era. Mm-hmm. And that threatens to seriously destroy wealth for the middle class. Because if your income's only going up 3-4% a year, and your cost of living is going up 8-9% a year, that means each and every year you will see a 3-5% pay cut. And you might be able to deal with it in year one, like most of us did, but can you imagine doing that year on year for a 10-year stretch? Just do the math. That is a 50% reduction in middle-class standard of living. And it's happened in other countries. If we have so many warning signs. You can look at what's happened in formerly wealthy South American countries,
right?
Like Argentina.
Argentina is a great
Chile,
example. Yeah.
Venezuela, which is probably the worst example.
Yep.
But even if you end up just with a situation like Argentina, where people are still getting by, but look at how their standard of living has deteriorated over a period of 10 to 15 years. That's what we have to look forward to here. And unfortunately, neither presidential candidate seems willing to address this problem. We should be frightened. And we should be demanding a plan from both of them.
Yeah, there's no way anybody's going to talk about curbing entitlements in 2024. That's just simply not going to be discussed by either side. That's never going to come up. And there are some folks that understand that the Social Security trust funds, for example, exist and that there are, say, let's say $2.9 trillion in those trust funds. They don't seem to understand that those trust funds are fully invested in U.S. treasuries. So in order to fund, you don't just go to the bank and take the money out of your trust fund. You've got to go to the government and say, now repay this bond from the same taxpayers that are having to pay for everything else, or print more money and then put it into Social Security. This system is so terribly broken. If you think about it as there is no pool of cash in those trust funds, but it's actually just government debt, you could kind of say there really is no surplus. There really is no trust fund. They're bankrupt today. But we have a mechanical flow of funds that's going to come from the sort of federal general fund into those Social Security funds to make up for the shortfall between payments to people who are on Social Security and the taxes being paid by the people who are still working. And
I'm with you on that. And here's where it gets really interesting, though, is the way the law is written. The reason why you don't have to be concerned year over year of your entitlements being withdrawn is because you at least legally have that trust fund. And so your payments next year are not dependent on what Congress does next year in relation to the entitlement system, because the trust fund is there to go ahead and make those payments for you. The moment that trust fund is empty, which is on track to be empty by 2034, at that point, Congress then has to make a decision.
Yep.
if they don't move on the issue, then entitlements basically are automatically slashed. If Congress chooses to act, that's when they're going to have to choose whether to just dramatically expand the printing and the deficit spending or enormous tax hikes. And tax hikes just in the wealthy would not be sufficient to pay for the revenue that's needed. If you really want to have year-on-year taxes pay for the entitlement program, you would end up with a tax system like you see in France, where most people here don't realize this, but the payroll, all-in payroll taxes on the middle class in France are actually above 50%. That's what you would actually have to do if you were actually pay for these promised entitlements if the corrections are not made today. And, you know, if we make some of these changes today in terms of retirement age and benefit situation and partial privatization, you can avoid most of the pain, or at least a good part of the pain. If you put it off, there's just no way around it. It's either you hurt those who are already on entitlements, which I really don't know that politicians would do, or you end up with a period of economic misery due to very high, possibly hyperinflation.
So we've only got a few minutes left, like 4.5 minutes left. So I just want to, this inflation thing we're going to have to keep talking about and trying to help package up and understand exactly how all these moving pieces come together, because I think it's very concerning, but people don't really understand it and it's hard to put it all together. But if we don't, as a country, start to make hard choices, we're going to get to the point where we can't. But coming just to the other topic, the jobs numbers, the latest story from the, you know, the leftists and their allies is that the reason the job growth that's happened since the lockdowns ended to now, and that those jobs have gone to immigrants more than to the U.S. citizen, meaning we still have something like 2 million American citizens that are native-born Americans who are unemployed or not in the workforce. We're 2 million less than we were when this whole thing started, and yet the job market seems bigger because you've got these incredible job growth numbers. Now, we talked before about the fact that a lot of that job growth is part-time jobs. So if someone loses one job and picks up two part-time jobs, that's considered job growth. And we know that we've lost full-time jobs. We've talked about that there are more part-time jobs being created than full-time jobs. In fact, we have a net loss of full-time jobs. But is it the fact that the reason we don't have as many native-born Americans working today is because these are just boomers retiring and they weren't going to be part of the workforce no matter what happened? Is that real?
Well, there's actually some partial truth to that. If you look at the total number of native-born employed right now versus 2019 before all the pandemic nonsense, it's roughly about the same. There's around 130 million native-born people employed today versus 129 million in 2019. And so it's just a very slight increase. And like you mentioned, we've actually lost several hundred thousand native-born employees over this past year. But here's where it gets interesting. There is some truth to the fact that part of the reason why the native-born population has stagnated and actually over the last year declined, part of the reason is because we are seeing a swelling of the 65-plus labor force. So I was doing some numbers earlier today on this, and if you look at the labor force participation rate, the percentage of the working age population that is either working or looking for work, in that prime age of 25 to 54, the labor force participation rate is 84%, which is actually pretty close to the historical average. The older the population level gets, the fewer people that are actually working or looking for work. So if you get to that 55 to 64 category, that participation rate is actually quite a bit lower. It's closer to 66%. Mm-hmm. Well, it really drops off when you get to 65 plus. Only about 23% of the 65 plus age population is working or looking for work. And here's where the numbers get really interesting. Each and every year, the last few years, you've had around 1 million Americans, about 85% of whom are native born. Mm-hmm. Around 1 million are stepping down and retiring. Mm-hmm. Well, that represents, if you look at the difference in the labor force participation rate of 65 plus versus that 55 to 64 category, that's about a 40% decline in the labor force participation. So if you multiply that 40% decline by that 1 million people that are now hitting that 65 plus, that represents around 600,000 native-born Americans that are dropping out of the labor force every year due to retirement. That's a significant number.
Yes.
And that does add up over time. So it is definitely part of the reason why we have seen that native-born population stagnate. And, you know, part of that too is because the number of births per typical woman for those that are already here that are native-born is in many parts of the country is actually below the replacement rate. So, which means that if it weren't for immigration, possibly our population might end up completely plateauing or declining. And, you know, that actually ties back into that entitlement situation, entitlement reform. If you look at the number of active workers per beneficiary, we are rapidly getting to the level where there's only going to be 1.8 under two workers per beneficiary.
Right.
You think about that as we're all working, paying for those that are retired. You know, these are daunting circumstances. So we've got to make some changes, not just in terms of entitlement reform, but getting your economy back into a high growth mode. This 1.3% economic growth, that is not going to cut it if we really want to help middle class families do better and also ensure that we can pay the benefits in a healthy manner for those that are getting into the 65 plus category.
Yeah, there's no question. All of these are issues. And when I look at the birth rates in this country and some other Western countries, what I'm saying is I want to understand why people have stopped having children. And I don't think it's all simply that women are in the workplace. I think it really is. And I hear this from a lot of young people. The economic burden that they have in trying to have a child is so heavy that many of them are simply just choosing not to. They just can't afford it. And I think we have to figure out how that can change as well. But this inflation is a big part of it. Now, if you come here as an illegal alien and you go to a hospital and deliver a child, you simply walk away. You don't have any bills. You don't carry away any debt. And that's been a condition in this country for a very long time. So it turns out if you talk to some of the younger folks, they'll say, listen, I'm not an illegal alien, so I can't just go have a child. I have to have all this money and I have to have this coverage and I have to be able to pay for it. And then I've got to, you know, it's... they're actually at a disadvantage at a time when we've seen housing costs grow so much faster than wages and other things that have really put an economic squeeze on people trying to start a family. I think that this whole economic paradigm we've put in place that is squeezing this middle class, squeezing the working class, and making it harder and harder for them to establish and build families the way people did 40 and 50 years ago, that's something that has significant social implications, real economic implications, and at some point is going to become a matter of national survival. You know, I don't think import a new country full of people without losing your culture and introducing these radical gangs. I mean, these violent gangs that are coming in from the countries that are sending folks here, these gangs are going to be violent at a level that Americans are simply not accustomed to.
No, I think it's imperative that the incoming president get the border under control. And look, there are some economists that I think overplay the economic trade-off with immigration, but we have to go beyond just what the possible numbers are in terms of is this actually helping us expand our workforce, but also keep in mind that we also have safety concerns to consider as well. And when we have sometimes 10,000 people a day coming across the border unvetted, that's just simply unacceptable. And a lot of our cities, such as Boston, which I visit Boston, New York, Denver on occasion, and it is noticeable how the quality of life has deteriorated because of the open border policy of the Biden administration.
I talked to folks, a guy in Boston a lot. He sent a text out the other day. He was sitting at his office and somebody was shot dead in the street in front of him. I mean, these are things that never were considered before, could not have happened. The decline of Boston is a harbinger of what's coming for the country. And I think most of us somehow are able to turn our heads away from that and other issues. So Joel, how do people follow what you're doing? If they want to track your where you are, social media, or how do we find you?
On X, formerly Twitter, at Joel Griffith, and of course on the heritage.org website, you can easily search by topic, and great work by both EJ and myself and other economists will show up. Or you can just key in my name and everything that I'm writing lately will show up as well.
Yeah, I actually use that website frequently because it's just a great place to go to get some good, good analysis, numbers that you can't find other places. So I use that a lot. Well, look, thanks for joining us today. I always enjoy these conversations, and we will take different positions on some of the big issues as we continue these conversations because you know, it's going to be fun to work through some of the impacts of things like trade and immigration, where we have slightly different points of view. But I always appreciate your insights and the work that you do. So thanks for joining the Conservative Voice.
Thank you. I enjoyed the real conversation and going over all these ideas and numbers. It never gets old.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. So, and we'll look forward to having you on again. So
wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. And so touching on some of things, we had a town hall last night, another Keystone town hall. And, in that town hall, we covered, a few different topics. And the big one, of course, was industrial scale child trafficking, which we're going to cover in the second hour with Kim Kelly from Uniting America, who will be here in the studio with us. But one of the issues that we talked about last night was the incredible shift that's happening around the world. You know, the shift that's happening is that we've got, for example, in Europe, a significant change. We've got a significant change in the political makeup there. We're seeing, if you followed the elections last week, we're seeing some real shift. So in France, for example, this National Rally Party won 31.5% of the vote for this EU election they had. And Macron then had to go and dissolve his government, and he's going to call a snap election. That is an incredible outcome. And if you look at Germany and you look at Belgium and Spain, Luxembourg, there are shifts happening where these nationalist and populist parties that are saying, hey, listen, we want to have national borders. We have a culture. We want to protect our citizens and do things that are for the benefit of our citizens. Italy, this is happening all across Europe. And when you see France, you know, somebody like Macron, one of the most entrenched globalists that are out there, for him to have to do that to dissolve it and dissolve his government and then come out for a snap vote, that's critical. Now, there's a woman named Marine Le Pen who has an anti-immigration nationalist party. She's been campaigning in France for a long time. This party's been growing. They got 31 to 32%, somewhere, let's call it 31% of the vote in France, which is more than double the share that Macron's Renaissance Party got. She got double the share that he got in this election. That is an alarming thing for the globalists to see. You know, those that have been dedicated to destroying Europe's borders, to mass migration at unbelievable levels, that are completely transforming their cities, changing their cultures. So we're seeing this reaction now from within Europe. Now, to be clear, that doesn't mean that the power shift is complete. So there's a group that's got a lot of control in Europe called the European People's Party. And there's a woman who is part of their government who is named von der Leyen, who is the head of the government there, the EU. And her group has lost power, but they're going to have to build an alliance with this group called the Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats, which are described as what? As progressive? They're Marxists. And then what they call a centrist liberal Renew Europe group to form this majority that they need to have to maintain control. When you look at the alliances and the way these parties line up, it's likely that von der Leyen is going to remain in control. But we're seeing for the first time a surge of people who are now having political power. If you remember over the last couple of years, we've seen the farmers come out and say, hey, we're not going to surrender our farms. We're not going to destroy our food supply. You've seen the truckers in Canada and other places beginning to stand up and say no. And we've talked on the show repeatedly about the reaction we're seeing inside some of the markets here, some of these key demographics. As we all know, the Democrat Party has relied on, accounted on, depended on the Black American population forever. And without that group, they cannot win. But we saw polling coming over the years where we went from, say, a 8% support for the Republican candidate in 2012. Donald Trump got about, let's call it a 12% support in 2020. Last polling was about 22%. And now we're seeing polling showing something in the neighborhood of 30% of support inside that Black community. We've covered this report repeatedly. We're seeing the same shift in the Hispanic community. We're seeing these shifts in communities that the Democrats have counted on, the globalists have counted on, the people that are working not just to bolster the economy or improve our economic reality, but the people that are driving this reckless spending, the people that are driving immigration that's so significant it's going to fundamentally transform this nation without the consent of its people. They're doing the same thing in Europe and Canada. We're starting to see the people rise up and push back. Now, I'm sure that the people in Davos that meet and decide how we're all going to live, that must make them somewhat uncomfortable, because they depend on the American people, the Canadians, and the Europeans remaining complacent to the point of complicity. They depend on us being comfortable enough that we just don't take action. But they're starting to see that shift. And so this campaign, this election in Europe, I think was really important, maybe a harbinger of some of what we see happening here in November. So what are the Democrats going to do about that? Of course, we know that Donald Trump is going to take the Republican nomination unless something incredibly unfortunate and drastic is done by the nation's enemies. So what are the Democrats going to do? And if you're paying attention to the rhetoric around Joe Biden, what I'm hearing now is more and more a discussion about Joe Biden being frail, and Joe Biden is older, and Joe is, just not as sharp as he was. Some Democrat said the other day, Joe Biden isn't quite as good a campaigner as he was 5 years ago, even. Well, 5 years ago, he campaigned out of a basement. He wasn't a great campaigner 5 years ago. He was completely ineffective 5 years ago. But, of course, he was handed the election, and here he sits in the White House stumbling around in Normandy a couple of weeks ago, stumbling around on the stage the other day, not knowing where to look. Other nations' leaders grabbing him by the elbow and escorting him back to where he's supposed to be. They sort of care for him as he is a incapable man who's lost his faculties, and he didn't really have strong faculties 20 years ago. He's never been a particularly strong policy person or national leader. He's been basically wrong on everything. So you see Joe Biden declining even further, and now you see the media beginning to tell us that. You see Fox News beginning to talk about it more. You see all the Democrat platforms now beginning to acknowledge that, and they're starting to call for a replacement. So that brings the question of who will replace Joe Biden. A lot of people are saying, how can he get replaced? It's too late. Well, it's not really too late, because the Democrats and Republicans pick their candidate at their conventions. And later in July, about 4 weeks from now, the Republicans will have the convention. But the Democrats scheduled their convention very, very late this year. And it's in August. And the state of Ohio had to have a special election just to make sure that Joe Biden could be on the ballot, because he was going to miss it. Well, of course, if Joe Biden flips out, they'll just put whoever the replacement is. So do people really think that Joe Biden is going to be the nominee? It's increasingly clear that no one does. Steve Forbes said the other day that he doesn't think so. Now, people are throwing out names and saying, well, who will replace him? And the debate seems to be between two different ideas. One is that they need someone with national presence, national identity, someone like Michelle Obama, or as many people like to call her, Big Mike. You know, people like Gavin Newsom. The problem with, say, Gavin Newsom is his state has an app that tracks feces on the streets of San Francisco. I mean, and if you look at the map that comes out of that app, it is just a giant brown spot. It is not that one or two places. I mean, they have so diminished and degraded their state and their cities that they have a mass exodus. And everybody knows him. So if they bring out someone with a national identity, that person is going to then have to deal with their baggage. Now, Michelle Obama's never held a leadership position in this country. She was married to a president. That's the qualification. That's probably not enough to really win over everyone. And then she's going to have to answer the question, why did you buy a mansion on the shores of the ocean where you put in a giant submarine-sized LP tank to fund your energy, LP gas, right? Not solar cells, not a windmill. Why are you living on the ocean if you're telling us the oceans are going to rise and wipe out our nation, wipe out our world, destroy society? Of course, it's because this climate change thing is a hoax and she knows it, and they just want to make the money from it and go live on the seaside. So who will be the likely nominee? I see a bunch of different options, and those options include governors. I think if they pick a governor who has very little national awareness and doesn't have a lot of, because they don't have a lot of public view, they don't have a lot of baggage that has to be addressed, then the Democrat media is going to be able to create a hero out of whole cloth. They're going to create whatever narrative they need to create. So the names that I went through at our town hall last night were Andy Beshear, the governor of Kentucky, who has bipartisan support, Jared Polis from Colorado, J.B. Pritzker, who Americans just don't know a lot about, out of Illinois, disaster of a governor, but could be characterized as a governor, an executive leader. Tim Walz out of Minneapolis, and of course, Pennsylvania's own Josh Shapiro. I covered that last night, and the first thing I saw this morning was an article saying Josh Shapiro or Hochul should replace, Michigan's governor should replace Biden. Now, I don't think that the governor of Michigan is a good candidate. She has that fake FBI kidnapping thing in her past, you know, just a lot of damage done during the lockdowns, a lot of death in their nursing homes, telling people they can't buy seats. She's got a lot of baggage. But these other names just aren't known publicly, and any story that has to be created can. I think that the biggest element they're going to want to push are three things. One, they're going to want to say this person is next generation, they're young. Younger than Trump, younger than Biden. Second, they are moderate. Now, none of these people are moderate, but the American public accepts now that a radical lunatic is a moderate, and anyone who wants to say preserve the Constitution is a radical. We've just been conditioned, as they've shifted what they call the Overton window, we've been conditioned to think that normal is extreme and extreme is normal. Tim Walz, of course, is the guy that watched his city burn when he had plenty of troops and plenty of state police to protect it, but handed a police precinct. They handed the crowds a police precinct to burn. And then, of course, you got Josh Shapiro, who we all know no one knows anything about. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. I think it's going to be an interesting topic. I think we should be alert, and we should all be realizing Joe Biden isn't setting domestic or foreign policy in this country. I've asked hundreds and hundreds of people that question. No one thinks he is. No matter who they put in that chair, the policies we're going to get are going to be the same: economic, trade, immigration, all of it. So I think we have to be thinking carefully that, you know, we're not looking at Joe Biden as the candidate. Someone else is. Now, the next guest we have joining us is Garrett Ziegler. Garrett, welcome to the Conservative Voice.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, you know, I appreciate you coming on. It's an interesting week. You know, you joined us for a Keystone Town Hall last year, and I got to tell you, people found it fascinating. And then, of course, we saw this week that Hunter Biden was convicted on the gun charge. So I pulled out my copy of your book. Now, for the listeners, Garrett Ziegler is the founder of a group called Marco Polo. And Marco Polo is the group that wrote the most comprehensive analysis of the famous Hunter Biden laptop that I think exists. And we had it at our town hall last night, and some folks were looking through it, and it's just shocking when you open the pages of your book and look at what was actually on that laptop. This is about a 600-page analysis with illustrations and captures of screenshots and things. I mean, just an incredibly full document that allows you to really understand what Hunter Biden was doing, and frankly, from that, what the whole Biden crime family was doing. So when he got tagged with this conviction, I thought, well, it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts, because I know you were there, and I believe that Hunter Biden's spouse went after you. So tell us what happened. What happened at the courthouse?
Well, thank you for having me on. And just real quick, on the event last September, it was good timing and weird timing because it was 2 weeks after this gun indictment. So I've known you for the entire pendency of this case, right? You got indicted on, I think, September 15th in Delaware for what my team has been calling this sort of the third rung of criminal activity. This, ironically, is not what Hunter should have been charged with. Now, he's guilty of sin of the three charges. The jury decided correctly. There was always some question whether there would be somebody who lied during the voir dire questioning and, you know, loved Joey and was there to sort of be a mole and try to get a hung jury. But they deliberated for only 3 hours. That was surprising. I thought it'd be a couple of days considering it was a 6-day trial. And it was long. A lot of it was boring because we already had, you know, learned the, like you said, the content of what the case was about. His wife, Melissa Cohen, the 5'1" pipsqueak, did come up to me and cuss me out and said I had no right to be there. I was more, you know, sticks and stones, you know that saying. I didn't care that she called me a POS.
Right.
That's just
you know, another day with these people. What I was mad that she said is that I didn't have a right to be there, because that affects more than me. The American First family believes that if they don't like you, you as an American citizen who pays federal taxes don't have the right to be in a federally funded courthouse. That's what made me mad. But again, it wasn't the time and place to respond to her. I did not respond to her at all. I never said one thing to the entire family in the entire trial. In fact, our mutual friend Linda went with me to the trial one day, and she'll attest to that. Me and Linda just sat there with our hands in our laps, and yet this is what the family did. You know, your listeners probably know that the prosecutors picked a class of criminal conduct that didn't touch on Joe. This was one of the 459 crimes to choose from. It lays out that hardly touches on Joe at all. The only mention of Joe in the entire trial was that Hunter took his Cadillac to go illegally purchase the gun, hilariously and ironically. But this upcoming trial in September in Los Angeles, which I will also be at every single day, that's the one I care about. And that's the one that that the country should care about more. That's what we've been calling the second rung, the second rung of the ladder, because that will touch on Joe more. One of the charges in that California trial is a 2016 non-payment of tax. So while Joey was the VP, Joe will be brought up a lot in California. It's not the first rung, which is what they're never going to bring because the prosecutors don't have the strength of character. That should be the far end money laundering violation. So in summary, the trial in Delaware was interesting. Ironically, one of the three charges, one of the three felonies that Hunter was convicted of is likely unconstitutional. And I'm sure you'd agree with me. I'm a Second Amendment absolutist. The 18 U.S.C. 922G charge of his possession, I don't think just being a drug addict deprives you of the Second Amendment. Even if you are a drug addict, you should be able to defend your family with a firearm if some nincompoop comes through your front window, right? So ironically, one of these three may be reversed at SCOTUS. And because we don't care about Hunter Biden per se, we care about justice, we cheer that on. That's what made Melissa's accosting so stupid, is because she's going after somebody who we've never lied about Hunter. We've never been accused of lying about Hunter or his sugar brother, Kevin Morris, who's from Media, Pennsylvania, who I figured out when I was there in September is literally just up the road. But Kevin Morris was there every day, a Media, Pennsylvania native, everybody, if you're listening in for Media. Kevin Morris, who's actually in the Media High School Hall of Fame. He was not a bad basketball player. He is behind the Biden crime syndicate now. He's been funding Hunter to the tune of $10 million, and his whole family has abandoned him in this process. In fact, during the trial, a huge story from the New York Post broke that said Morris's daughter basically accosted Hunter and said, "Stop taking advantage of my dad," because Hunter's milking him like a 4-year-old Holstein cow.
You know, there's no limit to what these folks will do. But you make an interesting point when they say you don't have the right to be here. They don't think you have the right to publish the facts. They don't think you have the right to free speech. We all know that it was Hunter Biden's laptop story and those 51 intelligence agency operatives who said it isn't real and you shouldn't publish it and pushed it off of social media. I actually got shut down on Twitter for having posted that. They don't believe in the Constitution, and there's a fundamental difference.
They truly don't.
They really don't. To them, the Constitution is a barrier to the end goal, and the end goal for them is ultimate and total power, ultimate and total immunity, ultimate and total wealth, unlimited access to public funds. Garrett, we've got about...
Well said. I couldn't say it better.
We've got about 2.5 minutes left, and so and we're going to hold you over if that's okay, if you'll stay a little bit so we can continue this in the second hour.
That'd be great.
So, you again, we opened up this book last night and took a look, and it is shocking. When you think about all the things that are in there, just in this last couple of minutes as a summary before we start again next hour, what is the, how do you portray that when people ask you, well, what's the problem? What did this guy do? What was on that laptop? What's kind of this shorter summary that you tell the average American citizen who really doesn't know?
Well, we say that it's so voluminous, we had to break it up into three categories: business-related crimes, sex-related crimes, and drug-related crimes. And those are in order of importance. The criminal activity is so voluminous, it's three big sections. The most important thing that he did in terms from a countrywide basis is his business model for a decade was FARA violations. And he was representing foreign principals without registering that representation to the Justice Department, which, in other words, is illegal. It's a felony. They charged Paul Manafort for it. And I guess just as importantly, all of the money that he collected from those foreign clients is subject to forfeiture, because when you commit a FARA violation, that is deemed laundered money. So that first tier, to go back, and I know we're on a time crunch, but that first tier, as I mentioned, what the charges should have been, it should have never brought this Delaware one, even though he's guilty. It should have been a District of Columbia or Delaware trial about FARA violations and money laundering, and not just for justice's sake, but that trial would feature Joe Biden's name every 10 minutes because people weren't paying Hunter for his intelligence or looks, because he doesn't have either of them, after, especially after the crack cocaine burned his synapses. They were paying him for the access to Joe.
That's right.
He's the chairman. He's the big guy. And that's what they were paying for, and paying handsomely.
So,
to the degree that Hunter could be smoking crack at the 15
Garrett,
minutes.
we're gonna break right there, and you're listening to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860. Stay with us for the next hour, and we're gonna start with Garrett, and then we're gonna move into the discussion with Kim Kelly of Uniting America. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Please stick around.